This is an ABC podcast.
Live across Victoria.
On the ABC Listen app.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
The conversations that are important to you. In your town. Your suburb.
This is The Conversation Hour with Rochelle Hunt.
Have you noticed that on some cars, it's hard to tell if their indicator is on or if their brake lights are working? More and more car designers, it seems, are getting very creative with all of the lights, from headlights, indicators, brake lights, whether that be the shape, the way the lights move, the size, maybe a logo that's placed into the indicator. Even headlights appear to be changing, so long strips instead of two traditional headlights. So, should lights on a car be an opportunity for brands to market their logo or to use their lights as a point of difference to stand out? Or should lights on a car just be off limits and purely for safety? Is there not a standard for car lights? And also this hour, over the weekend, the 2025 Australian Masters Games came to a close. Were you there? Did you compete? Or maybe you're thinking about becoming a master.
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
So are you finding car lights confusing? Do you even know if someone is putting their brake on, if they're indicating? And I found myself transfixed at the lights the other day, watching the way that one particular indicator worked and the way it sort of ran from right to left and the technique they used in the indicator, to the point where I wasn't really concentrating on what was happening around the road. So are car lights up for grabs? Can marketers, can car companies use them to stand out, to market their logo, or should they be essentially for road safety? This, finally, there's a discussion on the wild variety of lights on modern vehicles. It's absolutely absurd and it's confusing. That's from Andy. Richard's called through. Morning, Richard.
Oh, good morning. How are you?
I'm confused, but like that's not a first, and I'm sure it won't be the last. Car lights, have you just found there is an alarming and staggering difference between indicators, brake lights, headlights?
I have noticed that there's an article that I read just recently about that topic, and I'm a bit puzzled because the there's certainly Australian design rules that cover all sorts of things automotive that includes lighting, and they're very strict. Well, I understood them to be fairly strict and very specific. And I'm puzzled that there's been so much variation in different brands that can provide their own kind of take on that. And I'm suspicious that maybe there's someone in the regulatory system that probably might be asleep at the wheel.
Oh, nice pun too. Well, there's lots of people saying that, Australia has really strict ADRs for vehicle lighting compared to other countries. But so many of us have noticed this. Richard, thank you. In just a moment, we're going to speak with Professor Stuart Newsteed from Monash University Accident Research Centre to find out, what the rules and regulations are and why there's just such variety at the moment. Lee's out and about and on the road. Can you understand what people are doing and what they're indicating, Lee?
It's come to me. I said, sorry, I'm just about the lights.
Yes, and what have you noticed?
Yeah, well, look, I travel a great deal, and I'm finding travelling at night increasingly tricky because the colour temperature of the lights and the LED lighting is so intense and so dazzling that I think it's the most dangerous thing we do driving, and it makes it much worse. I have an enormous amount of trouble sometimes keeping the concentration, and the fatigue just goes through the roof with it, with the lights.
You're certainly not alone. There's a few people talking about a similar thing. Lee, because you're driving, we're going to let you try and drive safe. But this, it says, Rish, I'm so pleased you're shining a light on this topic, pun intended. Can you also include the alarming use of ultra-bright LED bar lights on cars, especially in regional areas? Modern headlights are so bright that they're now not safe for a lot of us drivers. Let's have a quick chat to Bernadette, who's in Hepburn Springs. Hi, Bernadette.
Hi, good morning.
How are you finding it? There's lots of us. The texts are flooding in, Bernadette, saying it's just crazy.
We have a lot of single, like, two-lane blacktop roads here, and at night it's freaky. You don't know whether they've got their high beam on or not, and you have to try and look to the side of the road because you're getting dazzled by these ultra-bright lights. The other thing is red indicator lights. Mm. I lived in the States for a while, and it did my head in. Because you can't tell whether they're braking or turning, because they're usually braking at the same time, and you can't, with the red lights, the same as the brake light.
It feels dangerous, doesn't it?
Yes, and with the influx of American-made cars, that's starting to be a thing.
And I wonder if that's the issue here, because apparently we've got really strict standards, but more and more of us are confused. Just another text from Vivian. Good on you, Bernadette. Thank you. And I know it's a big issue driving in regional roads too. I mean, remember the days, Bernadette, I sound like such an old person when I say remember the days, but you would flick your lights, you know, from high beam to low beam, especially on regional roads. You would change it. That just doesn't seem to happen as much anymore. Vivian says, I'm so glad you're talking about this. It's an issue that just hasn't been spoken about or approached by the government or Vic Roads, and it needs to be. Well, Professor Stuart Newstead is the director of the Monash University Accident Research Centre. Some texts, Richard, are saying this is a beat up, Rish. We have standards, and others saying, oh my goodness, this is such a big issue. What on earth is going on? Has it got anything to do, like our previous caller Bernadette said, with the number of American cars that we have on the road?
No, I don't think it does, because the American lighting standards are different to Australia, so they allow a combined brake and indicator light, which are both functions, but that is actually not allowed as a regulatory requirement in Australia. If you have a classic car that's imported under a limited import scheme, you might get that, but the American cars are imported for a mass sale in Australia won't have that. And certainly, as most of the callers have identified, there is very strict regulations through the Australian Design Rules for Vehicle Standards, which actually govern lighting. And I guess what we're seeing is more interpretation of what the regulations say about backlit badging, for example. So it says you can have a backlit badge as long as it doesn't exceed certain brightness. And I think with the invention of LED lighting, there's a lot more creativity in terms of colour design, etc., that can come up. There are quite strict requirements for colours of lighting as well. So the rear has to be red, the front has to be white, and the side indicator lighting has to be yellow.
And so it just feels like that's not the case anymore. I mean, here's just two of the, like, quite literally hundreds of texts that are flying in. Some indicator lights seem to be really small, especially on utes these days. And another from Christine that says, travelling behind a dark brown SUV just yesterday in that really heavy rain, the brake lights were dull, an upside down L-shape indicator were really difficult to see. They were definitely not bright LED lights, the exact opposite. They were dull. And like Christine from Croydon, who just sent that text to it, I've noticed all different shapes and sizes of indicators in particular. Is that too much of an interpretation of our rules and regulations?
Well, it's not an interpretation. It still actually meets the requirement of the regulations to be able to be sent here. But the question is, are the regulations adequate? And you'll have different experiences from different people, because lighting interacts with your visual acuity differently. For example, if you wear glasses, it'll be different. If you're an older person, you're suffering from cataracts developing, it'll be different again. And it's potential that the requirements don't really cover all the different acuity that people have in their vision out in the community, and certainly some people will struggle a lot. And that's particularly with LED lighting, which is a much whiter light, which a lot of people struggle with when they have developing visual issues. And so how we adapt to those and what the regulations should be doing around them is an unanswered question at this stage. So perhaps the the art of lighting has exceeded the review of the regulation as well.
This text from Greg, it says, I love my electric Peugeot, but I think my rear blinkers are invisible. A few times people have honked me or nearly run into me when I definitely had my blinker on. The other issue that people are talking a lot about at the moment, Stuart, is headlights and how they've changed, and in particular driving at night and driving in regional areas. Has there been a change to front headlights?
Well, it's really the adoption of LED technology, which has made them a lot brighter. Now, the Australian design regulations say that if the light is over 2,000 lumens, then you need to actually have a self-leveling system in the light and often self-cleaning as well to make sure that light is not in people's faces. But a lot of these, I think, come in just under that. But because of the colour intensity, they're very white, people still have a problem with them. And it's an issue that's only often picked up at roadworthiness time, of course, in Victoria, is only happens when the vehicle is sold. So it's perhaps that needs to be, given the brightness and the discomfort some people feel with these headlights, that needs to be a regular service item to make sure the lights are actually aimed correctly, because they can go out of alignment.
Should you be able to put your logo, there's a particular car that I'm thinking of where they've got a Union Jack or something, like should you be able to use it as a marketing tool? Is that space up for grabs?
Well, it is under the regulations. It said you can have illuminated logos as long as they comply with certain requirements, and that's things that can't be more than 60 lumens. But I guess back to the question of the issue of visual clutter, and we know that is an issue for people in identifying what is important. And it happens not just on a vehicle, it happens with roadside lighting as well. When you've got a lot of different lighting around, critical lighting like traffic lights, and becomes difficult to actually see the thing you need to see most prominently, it becomes a safety issue then. So it is allowed currently, but whether we should be allowing on vehicles to create visual clutter on the vehicle as well as the surrounding environment is a question I don't think we really understand very well.
I think that's, you sort of hit the nail on the head there in terms of the visual clutter. There does get to a point sometimes when you're at certain junctions or in some areas, and if the lights are all doing things that you're not used to, both on the cars as well as all of the signs and the changes to the speed limits, and all of our speed limits change all the time now, sometimes you have no idea where to look, and you have split seconds to make these decisions, don't you? Is visual clutter something on our roads, something that is currently being looked at?
It's certainly been researched a bit in terms of roadside visual clutter, and it's a major issue, but getting regulation around what people are allowed to do on the roadside hasn't made much progress either, and I guess we're now just seeing that transfer to the vehicle. So I think it really needs much more consolidated research and a think about what our regulation should look like to make sure we can get the safety critical information as a priority, and that it's accessible to all range of people. So those people who might be wearing glasses, older people who might have some visual deficits, it needs to be suitable for everyone. I'm not sure that our regulations currently sit in that space.
And because our cars are, over the last decade at least, and more so in the last couple of years, have just changed so dramatically in terms of where our cars are made, where we're getting them from, moving into electric vehicles. Professor Stuart Newstead is with you, Director of Monash University Accident Research Centre. We're talking about whether or not lights on cars have become too confusing, you know, whether they're used for marketing, whether they're used to stand out and not being used as a safety feature. Bob's just near Horsham. Morning, Bob.
Good morning.
What have you discovered? What have you found?
Well, I live in the country and do a lot of country driving, and there's two issues. One is the highly decorative blinkers these days, or indicators, I think these days, are more a fashion statement than anything else in a lot of cars. But one real issue in the country is actually the roadside signage we have, which is highly reflective. And when you're driving at night, particularly in kangaroo country, you cannot see past that sign, the reflective sign. So if there are kangaroos on the side of the road behind the sign, beyond the sign, you can't see them, because the signs are just too reflective and your eyesight can't handle that much contrast.
Yeah, it's scary enough driving at that time of the evening, especially at dusk when you're kind of on kangaroo watch. Is that something you've experienced, Stuart, that glare that Bob was talking about?
Well, I guess it comes back to the fact that our headlights are now so much more efficient with LED technology, how they interact with the retroreflective road signage and other things becomes problematic. Obviously, when you've got further penetration down the road, it's good because you can see the centre road markers, so you can see where the road alignment goes, you can see where the centre line is. But there's obviously issues around now with people seeing glare back from the signage. And animal strikes are becoming a major issue around Melbourne as we encroach on territory. So the particularly in the north of Melbourne, the rate of animal strikes has gone through the roof.
Absolutely, and that's a whole other conversation. Just finally, because I can't keep up with all the text, but they're very similar in that it's just got too confusing. Yes, we may have regulations, but there seems to be no enforcement. Just, you know, a text here from Dale, and it says, where's the enforcement here? And there's multiple exclamation points. Yes, we may have strict rules, but are they being enforced in any way other than, say, if you're pulled over to have your car checked for rego or whatnot?
Generally, no. It's actually something that is not very, very often enforced because it's difficult with all the different technologies and being able to test the vehicle at roadside to make sure it's ADR compliant is incredibly difficult for police. So, and also now we've got assistive technologies like automatic high beam. How well does that work? Do we have adequate testing for that? We've got auto shadowing headlights, which are supposed to blank out the oncoming cars. I don't know that we know exactly how these are working and how they will be maintained in the longer term. So there's a whole raft of things that are emerging, and it's always the case. Technology often leaps ahead faster than the regulation can keep up with them.
I know. Sometimes I just crave for the simpleness of cars, you know, where it's just like, oh, that's how you open the door. It's just a door handle. That's how you wind down the window. Like, it's really obvious. I'm sure I'm not alone in sitting in a car and turning to a friend or to an Uber driver and saying, how do I get out? It just shouldn't be that confusing. Stuart, thank you. Professor Stuart Newstead, Director of Monash University's Accident Research Centre. We are certainly not alone in just finding a little frustration when it comes to understanding brake lights, indicators, even front beams. Are we just getting too creative? We'll get back to more of your calls on that a little later in the program. But up next, when you go grocery shopping, how much brain control do you feel like you have? Do you make a list? Do you come home and start to unpack and say, why did I buy English muffins? I had no intention to buy muffins when I walked in. How much control do we have, and what really propels us to buy the stuff that we buy?
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
So when you go food shopping, what drives your decisions, and do you actually feel like you're in control? Do you need a plan? I mean, do you make a list? Do you have a strategy so that you know that you'll buy not only what you want, but hopefully pick healthy choices? Well, some new research has just come out, and it shows us how our brain works in the supermarket. And we're going to learn more about that research in just a moment. But Dr. Paul Harrison, Director of Masters of Business Administration Program at Deakin University. Paul, first things first, lovely to have you in the studio. We've never physically met face to face.
Amazing.
In person. I know, years. And yet here we meet for the first time.
Yes.
So we're going to learn about some research in just a moment that will show us how our brain works and what we're thinking about when we go shopping. But when we go food shopping, trying to make the best decisions, how much control do we actually have? You know, are we really thinking about what we need, what we want, what is good for us, or are we just purely being manipulated the entire time?
I think it's like all things, Rochelle, it's complex, and it depends on the context. So I guess the more processing capacity you have, the better your decisions, or certainly the more rational your decisions. And so one of the things that we see is that when people are overwhelmed with stimuli, they tend to make emotional decisions. And emotional decisions are driven by how something makes us feel. And there's huge amounts of research that kind of look at what people buy when they're under stress, what people do when they're relaxed and comfortable. I mean, we kind of talk about this idea is that we like to think that we're rational. We like to think that we can control things, but we are emotional creatures, and that's a good thing. It's just that what the supermarkets and what most retailers do is that they have a lot more knowledge about that than we do. we have, I guess, a level of, I don't know, arrogance to think that we're in control.
Yes. No.
And that gets in the way of good decision making as well. And
absolutely.
So I think this is the thing, is that they're not evil, but what these retailers are trying to do is to trying to force us or lead us to make the decisions that benefit them.
I like that you preface that with they're not evil.
Not individually.
En masse, well, maybe. Yeah, this is why we're coming home with extra packets of pasta that we didn't need.
Yes.
I want to pull apart what emotion does and how that influences our decision. And we'll speak to the PhD student who's done this research in just a tick. But Darren's called through. Morning, Darren.
Morning, guys.
Do you feel like you're in control when you go shopping?
When I go grocery shopping, 100% in control, because I go full. I make sure that I eat before I get there.
That's a really good rule. I try and squeeze in a bit of quick grocery shopping, Darren, in between finishing work and school pickup. And by then, I'm starting to get hangry, right? So my lunch is worn off. I'm feeling like I need my mid-afternoon snack. And I have to just use all of my willpower not to bust open a packet of chips while I'm in there, Darren. So that's your rule?
100%. That's the easiest way to do it.
And do you take a list?
Yes, I take a list. Oh, sorry. I have an instructed list that I take.
Yep. Okay. How important, Darren, thank you. Well done. We can all learn from Darren. How important is a list, Paul?
List is really important. Yeah. It's a rational processing. And what you're doing usually when you're writing a list is you're doing it in a time when you're not under stress. So I think that's the other thing. It doesn't mean that you have to remember everything when you go into the supermarket, but what it does is it gives you a plan. And the prefrontal cortex, the thinking part of the brain, likes a plan. It likes to think it's in control. And I think one of the things is that exactly what Darren was saying is, if you're hungry, you're actually not making great decisions, because you're being driven by this painful kind of thing, which is like, I need chips. Yes. I need sugar, fat and salt, you know, because there's going to be a famine. So therefore, I need to kind of stock up on these things. So, yeah, I think the lists are underrated, and I know they're a little bit daggy, but I actually see a lot of people in the supermarket now with their phones and lists. Again, going when you're not under stress, going when you haven't had an argument, or you know it's tricky when you don't have kids, when you're kind of jumping between different types of things.
Oh, that's a whole other world of pain.
It's a whole other world.
When you have a toddler or a child. Indeed. And going to the supermarket, that is a special type of hell, that one. It really is. Dr. Paul Harrison is with you. He's the director of the Masters of Business Administration program at Deakin University. And we're talking about this because some new research has come out, and Violet Shea is a PhD candidate in the Prediction and Decision-Making Lab at the University of Melbourne. First things first, Violet, I didn't even know in all of my decades I've been here at the ABC that there is a Prediction and Decision-Making Lab at the University of Melbourne. I feel like I need to access that lab at multiple times a day so you can just make decisions for me. What's going through? What did you discover in your research? What's going through our brains when we're trying to make decisions at the supermarket?
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me, Rochelle and Paul. So in our research, we wanted to investigate how quickly our brain processes different aspects of foods. And by that, I mean things like how healthy, how tasty, how familiar, how calorically dense different foods are. And we were interested in this timing because we know that aspects that are processed more quickly can have a bigger impact on our choices. So in our study, we showed people pictures of many different kinds of foods and also recorded their brain activity while they looked at the food using a brain imaging method called electroencephalography, or EEG, which can measure brain activity down to milliseconds. And we found that these different aspects of foods were reflected in the brain activity just a few hundred milliseconds after we see a food. And that's really quick before we're consciously making any choices.
Gosh, that is quick. Like, are most of us aware, Violet and Paul, put this to you as well, are we aware that we are making decisions that quick? Because sometimes I'm just standing there like a stunned mullet in aisles going, oh, I don't know which one. I'm like complete decision paralysis. Are we always making decisions that quickly, Violet?
So I think this is, you know, before conscious awareness, these few hundred milliseconds. So what this suggests is that These many food attributes are processed very quickly and automatically, and this unconscious processing might be influencing our food choices before we're even aware that we're making those choices. Yeah, so this kind of happens before that conscious choice process.
So, Paul, are supermarkets, shopping centres, are they onto this? Are they
of course.
Yeah, right.
Of course.
I kind of knew that was going to be the answer. So they need, I mean, if we're making decisions that quickly, if our first instinct, as Violet's research has shown, is that we actually are trying to do the right thing, we're trying to be healthy. So how persuasive are they getting then?
Well, I think too, and what Violet is talking about is this idea of this automatic processing. What the supermarkets don't want you to do is think. They want you to respond. And if that's coming from a point of not processing too much information, then that's really useful to them. That gives them the margins they need. They're constantly conducting experiments, and Violet will know this, without ethics approval. They're just doing experiments. They're trying stuff out. They're seeing what works and what doesn't. And then they're at the kind of big level, the average level, they're saying most people will respond to this. And a classic one is, you know, you put things like really delicious looking foods and images and things like that to create, I guess, a form of priming where people go, gee, I feel like I want to make that kind of thing. Even things like shelf height.
Oh, yes.
People process shelf height. If it's at that kind of at the kind of direct level of height, you process it really fast. So some research, and again, it's tricky to work out, you know, what happens here, but some research, you process it 20% faster than if you have to look up or look down. That's an advantage. It means it's just, we just give it more weight because it's easier to process. And that's really key.
Violet, I want to speak to you about that in just a moment. So there's tasty and there's healthy, and that came up in your research as well. But this is interesting. This is from Judy, and it says, Rochelle, your topic is so on point. I took a list yesterday, but I came back with Vietnamese spring rolls and crumbed prawns. I had no intention of buying them, and I certainly didn't need them, as I very rarely buy prepared food. Judy, I'm a sucker for spring rolls too, right? If they're at that height and they look good, I'm like, yes, I love spring rolls.
It's a reward. I think that's part of it as well. And even if you don't like them, you're told that they're delicious.
And it's, so you and it's a dopamine hit, exactly. Right? Yeah. Heidi's in Mansfield. Hi, Heidi.
Good morning. How are you?
Are you in control at the supermarket?
I take a list. I am in control, and I use cash. So once the cash is gone, I know roughly my budget. I can't spend anymore.
And that works for you, Heidi?
It works 99% of the time.
There's really interesting research too that shows that people feel pain more when they're handing over cash than when they hand over credit cards as well, like physical pain. So again, you know, using cash is a useful way. Physical pain, the same physical pain you feel when you get hit or something like that. So again, you know, and Violet would be aware of this, is this idea your brain reacts the same to that stimuli of handing over cash.
We are complex beasts, aren't we? Violet Shea is with you, a PhD candidate in the Prediction and Decision-Making Lab at the University of Melbourne. I feel like I want to go into that lab and see how you guys make decisions in there. But Violet, is there a difference when we're making those nanosecond decisions around what is best for us? Is it because we want to be healthy, or is it because we want to eat something yummy?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we had 12 different aspects that we looked at in our study, and you know, that's a lot of different features of foods, right? And we do find that a lot of these aspects are represented almost around the same time as well, in parallel with each other. So, you know, there's a lot of information that we take in unconsciously when we look at a food. And what you mentioned about that, like shelf height and all of these other engineering that go into supermarkets as well. Yeah, just from the moment that we see a food, where these processes are happening in the brain. So you can imagine that the foods that you see first in the supermarket are being represented more quickly and things like that.
But people would pay more for that space, Paul, wouldn't they?
They do. Yeah. They do. So you basically, well, it's often incentives or some kind of discounts or trade-offs or something like that. Often it's the most powerful supplier as well. What we're seeing in supermarkets particularly is that their in-house brands are starting to get a bit of an advantage because there's a margin there for them.
Don't get me started on tricking.
I won't then. I'm sorry.
No, you can. I love to whinge about this.
Okay, go for it.
Well, I've said once upon a time a lot today. I'm feeling every year of my 50 years. You knew what was a home brand. It was really obvious. Yeah. You know, they were quite literally black and gold, or they were no brands, or they were so plain. I do feel like we are tricked to a certain degree now into buying home brands because they're called greener pastures, mm-hmm. or you know, nature's children or something.
You should be in marketing, Rochelle. Nature's children.
I should be in marketing. But the world of home brands and being, I guess that might have come up in your research too, Violet, the labels and how the labels help us make decisions.
Yeah, so there's a whole different host of research looking at food labeling and things like the health star rating and things like that, and how that influences choice. In our particular study, we made sure to use foods with no advertising or labels or brands visible. So this research can't speak to that too much, but it's really interesting.
Dr. Paul Harrison is with you from the Masters of Business Administration program at Deakin University, and Violet Shea is with you as well, who is a PhD candidate from the Prediction and Decision-Making Lab at Melbourne University. We're looking at those split-second decisions we make in supermarkets and how we choose the food that we do, and how do we not get overwhelmed. Morning Rich says this message: a handwritten list and a pencil, and I mark off each item as I go when I put them in the basket. That's from Paul. I still prefer a handwritten list to my phone as well. And maybe, like, you know, at IKEA they have the little pencils. Maybe supermarkets should have.
They don't want you to.
They don't
They're
want
not
us
gonna
to.
Do that.
I'm going to start just leaving pencils around.
I think we should send all of the listeners out for a little bit of an experiment just to see the things that supermarkets do. I find it fascinating. I travel the world and look at supermarkets and go, oh, that's an interesting technique that they're using there as well.
My family has a shopping list WhatsApp group. Anything we need goes onto it. That's a special kind of hell as well. My family would just be adding to it all the time. My daughter would be putting on their chocolate and chips and all sorts of things. Let's have a chat to Madeline, who's called through from Melton. Morning, Madeline.
Oh, hi, Michelle. Good topic. I had a trick where I'd tell people not to look at the shelf price of something, which, you know, let's say $7.50 for this special. Look at the 100 grams price.
Yes.
But, however, I went to one of the big two the other day, and the sticker for the price of the thing, other than the special sticker, is so small that I couldn't read it. And I'm supposedly elderly, not very tall, had to climb down to the bottom shelf to look, and it's a tiny, tiny sticker.
You're not alone. I mean, for many of us, we can't read the stickers, we can't read the labels, and trying to get that information. When we're making decisions, Violet, where does price come into it? And like Madeline says, we can kind of be tricked with price as well. And I'm exactly the same as Madeline. I look at those, say, per 100 grams, whatever it may be, and all of a sudden you realise the more expensive butter is cheaper because it's bigger, and per gram it's better value. Violet, are we driven by price?
Absolutely. Price is definitely one of the key aspects that we would take into consideration when we're, you know, weighing up all of these different attributes. And this was something that we didn't include in our set of 12 attributes in the study, but definitely something that we want to look into in future studies as well.
And I think too, price is subjective as well. So I think this is the other thing, is that one of the things we try to talk to the accountants in my MBA program all the time is that just because something costs a certain amount doesn't mean that everybody sees that amount. So for some people, a coffee at $5 might seem like a lot. For another person, it's like, oh, that's just $5. And I think, again, price itself, even in a supermarket, it's what the person's priority is. So if a person is really motivated to, I guess, buy healthy food all the time for their family, they might trade off a high price for a healthy food for their family but buy something cheap for themselves. And that's the factors that we're not conscious of.
And this is, I guess, slightly broader lens to this conversation. I strangely found myself watching a documentary, believe it or not, on Aldi. It was on SBS. They did a documentary on the two brothers that started the supermarket. And a lot of what they were talking about was decision making. They've reduced, and what makes their model successful is that they've reduced the amount of decisions
choices that we make.
Yes.
That's right. It's a classic kind of study, which is you give people too many choices, they end up actually being more dissatisfied and often don't even make a choice. So it's a clever technique there.
Violet, in your prediction and decision-making lab, what other decisions are you making in there? What else are you looking at?
It's a really diverse lab
with
different people looking into different types of decisions. So there are researchers looking into voluntary choices. There are also researchers looking at more perceptual choices as well, which compared to something like a food choice, where you think about these abstract qualities of the foods. With perceptual choices, you're looking at more visual features like color or shape or orientation. So we really cover the whole decision space.
Right. So I can't call you when I'm on my way home tonight and I don't know what to make for dinner.
You need an app, Violet, just for Rochelle.
I'd be calling you every night, Violet. You would have me blocked real quick. Violet Shea, thank you. It's fascinating research. PhD candidate in the Prediction and Decision-Making Lab at the University of Melbourne. Just finally, Paul. There's an interesting text. It's come in anonymous, and I think they actually might be onto something. And it said the home brand changed because people were embarrassed to buy them. And I can remember growing up at school, if you had home brand products, you didn't want to take it to school. You know, if you had the home brand muesli bars or whatever it may be, you might have hid some of, you know, the home brand tin tomatoes if family members, you know, if friends came over. There was a stigma attached with it. Is there any truth to that, do you think?
Well, like all things in marketing for some people, and I think, again, there's a segment that actually saw it as a choice of pride as well, like I can make savings. And certainly in my partner's family, they were all about the home brand. And I think, again, it does depend, but this is very much about pushing the home brand into the mainstream. It's kind of responding to Aldi as well, because Aldi don't have their home brands, but they have all these crazy kind of brands, you know, like Nature's Children, for example. But the thing is that what it does is it removes what we would probably call dissonance, which is, okay, this looks a lot like the national brands, therefore I can feel a bit more comfortable about buying this home brand or this in-house brand because it looks the same. So it must be similar. And what we do is that we're constantly using shortcuts to help us to make decisions. And so if a label looks a bit like the national brand, it feels okay. And one of the things that, you know, Violet was talking about was this idea of this processing, this rational processing. The really interesting thing, and we can talk about this another time, is this concept of the great explainer, which is our rational brain actually then gets in the way of our emotional decisions and says, you're a good decision maker. The decision you just made is a rational decision. And so that's why you come home with spring rolls.
This is why we are so confused at the supermarket.
It's millennia.
And it's also part of the reason why we've seen the rise of the get, you know, like the meal kits.
Mm-hmm.
We're making the decision for you. You don't need that dinner paralysis.
All of that
stress. Yes. And there's more and more of them. Oh, it's fascinating. Always
indeed.
Good to speak with you, Paul. Thank you.
Cheers, Rochelle.
Dr. Paul Harrison, he's the director of the Masters of Business Administration program at Deakin University. Hopefully that's helped you when you go to the supermarket tonight. You're going to feel in control when you make those decisions. Coming up next, were you one of the many thousands that were in Canberra over the weekend? The Masters have just come to a close. So are you a sporting master? Did you compete?
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is the Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
So were you one of the thousands who were in Canberra over the weekend for the Masters Games? So the 2025 Australian Masters Games, they've just come to a close. After 8 days they were running for, there was nearly 8,500 athletes, as well as their families and loved ones who were there. There were 40 venues that took part, 44 different sports, and there was about 15,000 medals that were handed out. But what I love about the Masters is that there's so many different sports, and you can be of any age and ability level. If you were at the Masters or you had someone in your household that was, our number's 1-300-222-774. Adam Drinkwell is the general manager of the Australian Masters Games. Adam, oh, congratulations. You've just seen the Masters come to a close. 8 days. Did it all go to plan?
Thanks for having me, Rochelle. Yeah, it was a great week, and you know, we were blessed with some fantastic weather here in Canberra over the course of the 8 days. And as you know, with most events, there's always certain things that you know, you need to deal with throughout the week, but on the whole, it was a great weekend and great week for all our participants coming from all across Australia.
So this was like your highest participation level in a long time, since like 2011, is that right?
Yeah, that's right, since it was last, that year was down in Geelong. So it's been great to get up around that, over that 8,000 mark again in terms of registered participants. And, you know, Canberra put on a show, and it was really the first time we've had the games located on the east coast of Australia for a number of years. So we think that's had a bit of an effect on our numbers, which is great. And, yeah, you know, we have people in New South Wales, Victoria, Queensland, obviously homegrown ACT, WA, and we even had over 150 from international visitors as well come and join us.
Isn't that amazing? Why the rise in numbers, do you think?
I think there's just a great Masters community out there who continue to be active and playing sport, and they see the Australian Masters games and other similar events as a great way to reconnect, come back together. That camaraderie aspect of sport can never be underestimated, and what that does, you know, with our physical health and mental well-being as well. When you get involved with teammates who you haven't seen for a long time, and you know, they come back together just for these type of events, and we think that's a real positive. It's real positive for society as well, making sure people continue to be active, and we're just one of those tools that provides that. And yeah, really grateful for the support that's been shown by the Masters community here in Australia.
Yeah, hey, we're going to learn about one in just a moment that was invented in Newport. Stay with us, Adam. Adam Drinkwell, the General Manager of the Australian Masters Games, is with you. They've just come to a close. If you competed or if you went along, our number's 1-300-222-774. Caroline, you're in Camberwell. Morning.
Good morning, Rochelle. How are you?
I'm good. I reckon you're better, though. Where have you just come back from?
Yeah, I just came back from a fantastic week in Canberra, playing 50s-plus age group soccer, and we came home with a silver medal.
Oh, congratulations.
Congratulations.
Yeah.
How exciting. So how long have you been playing soccer?
Actually not that long, probably just a little bit before COVID. I never was a soccer player, but I played a lot of sport and joined a wonderful group of people in Melbourne playing Masters soccer, and always learning, not that elegant, but always determined.
That should be your motto, not elegant, but determined.
So, yes, it was a wonderful experience. Had about four or six Victorians. We all went up and joined a Canberra team, and we had the most amazing time with the most amazing group of, all the Masters games, really, but yeah, it was fantastic. It was unbelievably organised.
Oh, good. That's good to hear, Adam.
So
it was very organised.
So inspired.
So, Caroline, for many of us, we think we get to a certain age, and especially if we're looking back on sports we used to play when we were in our teens, we go, oh, I can't do that anymore. Oh, my knees, oh, my hips, or whatever. Oh, they're not going to be able to handle it. How do you go starting a new sport? I mean, do you modify the intensity or the rules, because parts of us don't work as well as it once did?
Yes, no, certainly. I think it's there's more opportunities for making sure. I think we're more aware of maybe those modifications, and certainly you've got to work within your means. And that, you know, now there's walking soccer and walking football and walking netball, so you've got options when you are older. But now, if you feel you can take it on, I think we all still have the same doubts. Can we actually still do it? But you need the community to encourage you to say, yes, you can, have a go. And that's what Masters does, I think.
Caroline, well done. Where are you putting the medal?
I've actually got it sitting next to me at the moment, because I thought I should maybe show it off to some work people. But, we had the closing ceremony, and I tell you, there were a lot of medals and a lot of proud people at the closing ceremony, that's for sure.
I'll wear that medal. I would be wearing it all at least all week, Caroline. Well done. Adam, I mean, hearing Caroline starting later, that was soccer. She just reeled off a heap of different sports. You know, we know that walking footy and walking netball's been a sport for some time now and a great way to stay involved. What are some of the other sports that people maybe haven't even thought about that were a part of the Masters?
Yeah, well, we've got some all different types of sports. All different types of sports that are involved in the Masters games, and they vary from, you know, some of those higher intensity ones where you've got things like hockey and swimming and athletics and all these type of things. And we've also allowed for para athletes to compete. Archery was very popular as one of our sports for para athletes. And then we've got some other ones that we've had, equestrian, for example, and the dressage was a new sport that we brought in this year, weightlifting and powerlifting. So some of those strength sports, which proved to be really, really popular as well with our athletes. So they're just a sort of a number of
Absolutely. And dragon boat racing, I know we did a whole conversation hour on the history of dragon boat racing, and I know that was there. Adam Drinkwell, the General Manager of the Australian Masters Games, is with you. The Masters have just come to a close in Canberra. But let's talk to Paul Thomas, who's the President of the Victorian, now I hope I'm pronouncing this correctly, is it Trago or Tragot Association? How do I pronounce it, Paul?
It's true go.
True go.
Have a true go.
Have a true go. Couldn't get any more Aussie if you tried. So now this, I tried to figure it out. It's kind of like croquet but upside down. And that's the best way I could think about it. You have to sort of put your head between your legs and use the little mallet to hit a disc. Oh, I'm doing a really bad job here, Paul. Can you explain how true go works?
Yeah, look, I can give you a hand. It's not too yoga-like. So basically you've got a rubber ring, a wooden mallet, and you have to hit that rubber ring down a corridor, which is 90 foot long, to short, stubby goalposts. And hopefully it goes through the goalpost to score a goal. But you have to do this backwards. So that's where the bending over comes. And, yes, you're... your posterior has to be raised as you swing through your legs.
Get that butt in the air, absolutely. So, Paul, its history is really rich for our western suburbs. This was a game that was created in a workplace in Newport.
That's right, created in the Newport Railway Workshops. We actually, most of this had previously, up until November last year, been maybe hearsay, tradition, legend, etc., but we've just putting together some harder facts. The history has been quite difficult to do because most of it was lost, but piece by piece we're putting it together. And we now know that in 1919, the Victorian Railways decided to introduce electric trains to the metropolitan system. And part of that, they just stuck these electric engines on carriages, just old 19th century carriages, and they needed a suspension system. And part of that were these rubber rings, which had been put underneath the engines to help with the suspension. And the workshop people there, they took the rings and they chucked them and threw them and hit them in all sorts of ways. And that's where the game of True Go evolved out of this Trugo ring, the ring that had been used as part of the suspension system.
So it's a workplace, how to kill time at a workplace and have fun. So is it played in other suburbs other than in and around Newport, Paul?
Well, up until the 1940s, there were no clubs east of the Maribyrnong River. That's how local it was.
Wow.
Only along the Williamstown-Footscray railway line. Then the mayor of Melbourne was very inspired by the fact that this was really a grassroots sport, and during the war they needed to have health campaigns, fitness campaigns, and he introduced it to other suburbs in Melbourne. But if we look today, we still have all clubs within a 10-kilometre radius of Southern Cross Station. So it's one of Australia's very rare heritage sports, and a characteristic of heritage sports is they tend to be very, very local.
I love that. And so was this your first year competing at the Masters? Did you have enough teams?
Well, I didn't think we would, to be honest. I had a meeting with the folks there at the Masters Games, and I tried to bluff my way in thinking, oh, geez, look, we'll try and get enough teams. But really the response was outstanding. We had, in the end, about 48 players made the trip to Canberra. And then some interstate sides formed specifically for the Masters from Queensland, New South Wales and the ACT. So we're a generous people, the Victorians. We've let everyone play Aussie rules, so it's fair enough that we give them a game of True Go as well.
And how did you go?
Look, it went very smoothly, surprisingly, given that we had to bring all the gear up from Melbourne. And people, you know, there were some people joining in who had never really played
the game. Yeah, you might have some new members.
Well, we had a wandering game of a group of cricketers who had their game cancelled. They were from Queensland and New South Wales, never heard of the sport, and wandered in, and they end up playing the whole tournament. So,
I love it. You might get some new members, I reckon, Paul. Thank you. Well done. And I love learning about it. There's a text here that says, I remember watching guys playing Trugo in Queen's Park Moonee Ponds on the way home from primary school back in the 1960s.
Yes, sadly a defunct side now, but the Ascot Vale's still going.
Paul, thank you. Paul Thomas, the president of the Victorian Trugo Association. Adam, let's have a chat to Leanne, who's in Painesville. Hi, Leanne.
Hi, how are you going?
You've just come back from Canberra?
I have. We were there at the start, so we did the opening ceremony and 3 days of dragon boat racing.
I love dragon boat racing. How did you go?
Yeah, 2 silver medals. So
congrats.
It's fabulous, yes.
When did you get started in dragon boat racing?
When we moved to Painesville 3 years ago, they started up a team and I joined it and, yeah, love it. So, and if anyone wants to come down and have a go.
You're more than welcome. And that's the thing. Congrats, Leanne. And just finally, Adam, I mean, Leanne just summed it up there. If anyone wants to come down and have a go, and that pretty much should be the top line of Masters Sports and the Masters Games, is that anyone can come down and have a go.
That's right, Rochelle, and that's the best thing about the Australian Master Games. There's never any real qualifying or anything like that. So, you know, it's open to anyone within the age brackets, and it's just a great way to either compete in the sport that you're passionate about or, as we've heard, try new sports and experience the Masters Games and the atmosphere that comes along with such a big event that we've just run. So,
well, congrats.
We encourage anyone out there, get involved in your local sporting club or be prepared to try a new game and there's no age limits, that's for sure.
Well, now you can have a lie down, a well-deserved lie down, Adam.
Yeah, it's been a busy week. It's been a great week here and there. We just thank all our Masters competitors for coming to Canberra and supporting the event, and the ACT government did a great job in supporting us and hosting it here in Canberra. So, and we can't wait to see where it goes in 2 years' time in 2027.
Adam Drinkwell, General Manager of Australian Masters Games, thanks so much.
Thanks, Rochelle.
That's it for today. Thanks for listening. Take care and we'll speak to you soon.